What's up, everybody? I'm Anna.
And I'm Jocelyn.
You're listening to episode 12 of Escape Expeditions, a podcast where we talk about escape room reviews, recommendations, and other industry nonsense.
Here's the jingle.
Enjoy!
Starting route to Escape Expeditions. Continue listening for 45 minutes.
Today, we are going to be discussing some hot-button topics in the escape room industry.
Yes, today's episode is industry nonsense, and we are talking about controversies.
So, throughout all of our experience in the industry, we have come across some topics that keep coming up over and over again that people always seem to want to argue about, and we would like to offer our two cents on these topics today.
Yeah, so fingers crossed that we disagree on something.
Yeah, hopefully. Or I'll just be like, oh yes, I agree with that again, like every one of our other episodes.
Either way, we will passionately argue one way or the other, even if we are arguing against no one.
We're arguing with the void that we speak to every day.
Yes.
But we shall see how it goes. So, I made a list of 6 things that we're going to be discussing today, and I guess we can go ahead and dive in.
As the kids say.
Do the kids say that? I don't know what the kids say anymore. I don't know.
So yes, what's number one?
Number one is, should a game be public or private?
Yeah, so it's easy to think about this from a player perspective, because obviously, in my experience, 90% of the people who come in and try to play games want a private experience.
I'd say more than 90%. Most people, I would think, either want a private experience or expect a private experience.
I think,
not that they would be disappointed if they find out that they're paired with other people, just that they go into it thinking that they won't be.
Normal people.
Right.
Like non-enthusiasts.
Correct.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I think I have definitely met both new players and enthusiasts who prefer public games over private.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but yeah.
I mean, it's always like fun to meet new people who are interested in the same thing you are, and having other people help you if you get stuck with something, if you have a group that's too small or inexperienced or whatever. So it's not always a negative thing to be paired with strangers.
Right, but from the perspective of someone who's spending $30 on an experience that you can only have once, you don't want your experience ruined by someone who doesn't speak the same language as you.
Which has happened to us multiple times.
Yeah, so story time.
Mm.
I think the worst public experience, public game experience that we've had was at Undead.
Yes, the game is called The Undead, and it is at
Escape Room Entertainment Melbourne.
Yes, which is, I think, now is owned by 321 Escape.
Yeah, but they still operate independently, I think. Like, they still are two separate places.
Yes, so essentially this is a zombie bunker game where you start off in, like, two different bunkers, and then you have to communicate with the other side to meet up eventually. Like most split start games, you meet up eventually. But these people that we played with didn't want to, like, evenly distribute among the two sides. So, like, whenever we play a split start game, sometimes we'll have me on one side with some people and then Jocelyn on the other side with other people, so that we know that at least we can communicate with each other.
Yeah, which is how I always recommend a split start for anyone, because where I work, we also run a split start game. So I always recommend for people to separate not just, like, the talent, but the
mostly the talent.
No, mostly the communication. So, like, if you come in and you're 6 couples, you should not put six couples.
One and a half couples on one.
Way too many. Six people. No. So, a better example.
3 couples.
No. A better example is if you come in and you're 2 couples, people always want to split one couple on one side and one couple on the other. When in reality, like, a guys versus girls split makes way more sense, because at least you know you have someone on the other side you can talk to, assuming you can communicate.
Right. So we're getting a little off topic, but the point is that when we split up, when we played this game with people we had never met before, it was a complete and utter disaster.
Yeah, it was horrible.
So we were trying to communicate with them, and eventually our game master had to come over the intercom system and basically tell us what the other side was seeing, because no matter how much we communicated to them, they just, they couldn't count, okay? It was just like a counting puzzle. Like, count how many, like, of these things you see on the wall. Like, they could not even do that. So, it was just...
They couldn't even put codes in the into the lock. I remember telling them, put, for example, like, put 1, 2, 3, 4 into your lock. And they were like, what? No. I'm like, this is the code. Put it into the lock.
Yeah.
And they would not do it. I was, like, yelling at them. I don't yell at people.
No. So, long story short, we only got, like, halfway through the game in the 60 minutes. There was a whole conversation with the owner afterwards, and we were basically compensated with a free game to come back and play it again, because we had such a terrible experience. And they could see that we were having a terrible experience. So, after that, I kind of had a tainted view of public games, but we've also had such great experiences meeting new people during public games.
Right. From a business sense, of course, it makes way more sense to have public games because you can make infinitely more money than you can with private games. However, if you have very negative customer experiences over and over and over again, which will lead to, like, you having to comp games or negative reviews and things like that, then it can go either way. I think the best solution is like a sliding pricing scale. So, like, if you have two people, the game costs more per person than if you have eight.
But it's still private.
Yeah, but it's private. So, I understand, like, you have a room that holds 12 people, and you have two people playing it, paying the same price per person as if you had 12 people playing it. Like,
it makes no sense for you to have a private game because you're never going to book out your game and you're going to lose money.
Right. Obviously, as a player, I'm very appreciative of games like that that exist because you're doing it because you care about the customer experience. In my opinion, the solution is a sliding scale, like somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, and if you do that, I mean, people might complain that the price goes up a little bit, but if you tell them that you're only going to be there with your group and it's going to be a private experience, usually people are more, like, agreeable with that solution.
Yeah, for sure. So you may get less customers overall, but it may balance out because you're making more money per person.
I think it really depends on your market.
Sure.
And, for example, The Escape Game has only public games. But in Orlando, they're in a high traffic, high tourist area where they have fully booked public games all day long.
Yeah, and if they end up getting negative reviews or if they have to comp a game because the game was really terrible or something, it doesn't matter because they're making so much money anyway. Is that better for the customer experience? Absolutely not.
Yeah, it really, I think, boils down to who your average customer is and where you are and what is the capacity and difficulty level of your game. Because also, you don't want to compromise the customer experience by allowing a private group of two to play a game that's impossible to finish with two people. Because right. No one is going to have fun if they only get 50, 75% of the way through your game just because they're playing by themselves.
This is why I returned to the sliding scale, which is not good for us because we pay...
We always play as a group of two.
So we would pay, like, crazy amounts per ticket, but also, like, we would book it.
Right, because we're crazy.
Sure, but
we have an escape room podcast.
Right, but I would rather pay, like, $35 instead of $25 to play privately.
Yeah, I think it's all just a matter of preference because we've definitely knowingly booked a public experience because we wanted to play a game so badly, and either we get lucky and we end up playing alone anyway, or we, you know, get booked with strangers and just deal with it. And for example, like when we booked our 13th Gate games yesterday, there was a caveat on their booking website that said, no, these are public games and you may be booked with strangers. you may be booked with a stranger who has already played the game before.
Yeah, this is rare, but it does happen. To ensure that this doesn't happen, book all 8 spots.
Yeah, which, no, we're not going to book all 8 slots. But just the fact that they have written that down, to me, means that it's happened before and they've had people complain and they just went, sorry.
Yeah.
Also, to be fair, those games are so ridiculously cheap. We paid like $25 a ticket.
Right, which we will talk about on our upcoming episode. But now, back on track.
Okay, so I think we've discussed public versus private pretty in depth.
Yeah, sure. What's next?
Next is, should you have to pay to beta test a game? Short answer, no. Long answer.
Yeah, so I have a lot of feelings.
This has turned into a therapy session for us.
My main example that I use when talking about this is that, okay, I make movies also. Before the film is finished, you have a bunch of different rough cuts, like unfinished versions of the film that you're showing to people to get their opinion. So then you can use their opinion to change the product that you're making.
Correct.
Right? That's what beta testing is with a game.
Mm-hmm.
But you would never charge someone
to watch your rough cut. To watch
your rough cut and then help you fix it.
That's absolutely ridiculous.
It's like, that's like paying to go see a movie at a movie theater.
That's unfinished.
That is not done.
Right.
To me, it's absurd. Have we paid for beta games? Yes.
That's just because we're impatient. So I think the rationale, just to say the other side of the argument, the rationale for charging people to beta test is that they're still getting, you know, a semi-finished product, and you're not charging them full price, so in theory, they're still getting what they're paying for, right? Because if they came to play the finished product, they would be paying $28, $30 a person, but if you charge them maybe $15 or $20, then, you know, you're only getting that percentage of the experience.
Sure.
But so that's why they're charging, but It's what you said. Like,
it doesn't carry over to any other industry. There are plenty of industries where people are beta-ing things, playtesting things. People are playing video games to see how they play, and then they're being changed before they're released where you can buy them.
Right.
You're not paying for that.
It's essentially like charging someone to do you a favor to give you their opinion.
Also, if they have paid for that product, their opinion is different.
If they haven't paid, then they're going to give you their honest feedback.
Also, if your beta is open to the public, you have no way of knowing that those people are going to give you their honest feedback because they're paying to play the game, which is why they're going. Their motivation isn't to help you make the game better. Their motivation is to play a game for half price.
Right, exactly. And you want to ensure that the people who are beta testing your game not only give you honest feedback, but actually know what they're talking about. Because how can someone who is not good at solving puzzles or has not played very many escape rooms, how can they tell you how to improve your game?
Sure, I disagree a little bit. You need to have people who have never played before play it. You need to have people who have played a bunch. You need to have people who have played a bunch but aren't very good. You need to have, you know what I mean? Like, you need to have a variety of people playing it.
Okay. So that you can see how
it goes.
I see what you're saying, because your point is essentially that not everyone who plays your game once it's finalized is going to be experienced, right?
So, right, the majority of people are not.
Right. So if everyone who beta tests your game solves your puzzle, you might not be able to figure out a different way to solve your puzzle from a perspective of someone who has not done many.
Sure, yeah, and you want to put new players in there to see if they're going to do something crazy, or you really have no idea how people are going to react or approach the situation, because it's impossible for you to think about the situation without knowing what the situation is.
You right. know what I mean? And as a designer, it's also nearly impossible to predict how people are going to perceive solving something when the whole time you've been designing it, right? You
know what the answer
is. You know what the answer is, and you know, okay, to solve this, you have to go from this step to this step to this step. You can't, like, think, well, maybe someone thinks about it this way, or maybe someone thinks about it this way. You could think of as many different iterations of it as possible that people might come up with, but it's not until someone who has no idea what they're looking at gets in there and tries to solve it, that you're actually going to see what other people's thought processes are.
Right, which is why you need a variety of people to play through it. And you also need people who are going to tell you the truth, because you can only gain so much information from watching them play it and learning what they think. But really, like, their opinion of the game is what is also important. You don't want to put a game out into the world that sucks. If you have 5 different groups, they've all paid to play it, they come in and play it, and you ask them about it afterwards, and they say it was great because
they got a good experience for half price.
Right, and also, they don't care. Like, they're not there to help you. They're there to play the game for cheap.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Also, it just boggles my mind that you would think that it's a good deal to charge someone money to ask them to help you make your product better.
Yeah, right, of course.
That's just like, I don't get it. I don't get it.
Yeah, so
that's like if I was an author and I wrote a book and I was writing a draft of it and I was like, hey, can you pay me half the price of what the book is going to sell mm-hmm. for to help me edit the book?
Right, of course.
You wouldn't do that. That's just crazy.
It's the same, yeah.
Okay, that's kind of similar to your movie analogy, but
yeah, but
we have a stack of books over there, which is why I thought of it.
Yeah, I understand. So to wrap up this point, I understand why people do it. It doesn't make any sense. It's not going to... It doesn't accomplish the main goal, which is to actually test your game and get honest feedback about it. That is what is more important than selling tickets, right, in my opinion, because the longevity of the game depends on that.
It accomplishes a short-term goal, which is, I've been working on this game for 9 months and I need to start making money on it now.
Right.
But that's not what's going to help your game be good in the long run.
Also, if the game is terrible in beta and people pay for it, they're going to talk about it.
They're going to tell us about it.
They will absolutely tell us about it.
And
then we will be talking about it here into this microphone.
Correct. All right, let's move on. Because I'm getting heated.
We're not even arguing. We're arguing with no one.
No, we're arguing with the camera. All right. Our next topic is having one game master watch multiple games at a time.
I'm sure you guys know how we feel about this topic, but we thought it was important to talk about it.
Yeah. For people who have never been a game master before or know how game mastering works, essentially what you do is you wait for the customers to show up and greet them when they arrive. And after you check them in, make them sign their waivers, whatever, you go back into the game, make sure everything is reset. Usually, by the time the customers show up, the game has already been reset. So you're just in there.
Hopefully.
So you're just in there finalizing everything, making sure everything is closed, all the magnets are stuck, all the doors are locked. And then you go back out to the lobby, grab the customers, bring them in the room, do the whole spiel, and then go back to the control room to start watching their game. So if you have to do that for multiple groups, one of the groups that you're watching before is going to fall through the cracks.
Right. Also depends, because it depends on how different places do it. The places that we have worked at have always run where the person who's bringing you into the room is the same person who's watching you in most scenarios.
Right. And in a lot of the smaller venues that we have visited, that's the way it works. In a lot of the larger, more corporate style places, it might be run a little bit more systematically, where there's, you know, a lobby person who's the greeter, and then someone who brings you back into the game, which is a different person, and then a different person who's already in the control room watching. So it just depends on how many people are staffed.
Sure. And the way that it's run in general. But I don't have an issue with the person bringing you in the game being different than the person watching your game, as long as one person, in my opinion, is watching the game. It's better, obviously, if you can build a relationship with your game master and you can talk to them. I always ask people what their clue preference is, for example. If I run a game for enthusiasts or brand new players, or usually I don't ask brand new players because they don't know, but I always ask enthusiasts if they prefer for me to not say anything to them at all unless they ask for it, if they want me to jump in and help them if I can tell that they need it, if they want me to ask before I talk to them and then tell them. You know what I mean? Like, it depends on the situation.
This is a different topic that is actually number
right
4.5 on our list.
I'm getting to my point. The reason that I brought that up is because that conversation would not happen if I was not the person bringing them into the game.
That's true.
And watching them and talking to them afterwards. So, like, from a customer service perspective, you're, like, building that that relationship the entire time. So, when they're playing the game, you know, you can have a little bit of personality. You can talk to them. You can get their names. You can talk to them directly instead of just being, you know, like, an ominous voice of God from the ceiling.
Yeah, but the main point that I'm trying to make here is that if there is one person in the control room with three different monitors in front of them watching three different games, or even two different games, it's almost impossible to keep track of what everyone in each game is doing. Because you have maybe groups of between two and six in each game, and you're trying to monitor what each person is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's a non-linear game, maybe there are different groups working on different puzzles, and you need to keep track of what they've solved, what their thought process is, to be able to give them the best possible clue. And the attention to detail is just not there if you're watching 30 people playing at once.
Right, of course. In my opinion, there's a major difference between being able to look at the screen and calculate very quickly what part of the game they're at and what they need to open next, versus actually watching their game and understanding what they have thought about doing, what they think is the right answer, what they're considering, something that they missed because they walked past it. You know what I mean? Like, those are the things that you're not going to notice if you're watching more than one game at a time.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to look at two monitors at once and see, okay, this group is at this stage in the game and this group is at this stage in this other game. But if group number one asks you for a clue and you didn't notice that the mom in the group said the right code but just didn't put it into the lock right, and you give them a clue on that puzzle because you think they haven't solved it, they're not going to be happy about that.
Right, they're going to be frustrated.
And if you have to, oh my god, if you have to ask them what they're working on, okay, this is my, like, one of my number one pet peeves. If you are being paid to sit down in front of a monitor and watch people play an escape room, you should not have to ask them what they're working on. That's literally your job to know.
Right, of course. Yeah, and I think it's acceptable to be like, hey, what code are you trying? If you think they're doing the puzzle right and just aren't putting it into the lock. You know what I mean? Things like that. Or, hey, like, I saw that you guys did this. You know what I mean? Like, to clarify something if you're a little bit unsure. But you can't ask them. I remember we were playing a game once, and we asked for a clue, and they said, write down what you're doing on the whiteboard.
Yeah, so that they could read it and see what we were doing.
Like, a sentence.
No, that should not happen.
That was insane. You know what I mean? But that is happening because that game master is watching more than one game at once.
So, I can understand if, from a business perspective, you have absolutely zero budget for extra staff. Okay? That is a difficulty that a lot of new businesses have.
Sure.
And if you open up with three games and you have no budget to hire anyone, you might be forced to watch two or three games at once, but that should not remain the standard operating procedure for an escape room business.
If I ask for a clue and you have to type it up, you have to glance at the screen because there's a lot going on, trust me, I have been in a situation where I'm juggling a lot of things at once, sure. But if it's like taking you 2 minutes to answer me and then you say, what are you working on? Like,
yeah, no, that definitely should not happen. That's not what I was trying to say. What I was trying to say is that there might be people listening who own an escape room or know someone who owns an escape room that has to watch multiple games at once, not because they think that's the best business practice, but because they just can't afford to hire more people to watch more games. And my whole point is that that is okay if you acknowledge that it shouldn't continue to happen if your business grows.
Sure. I also can understand if it happens occasionally, right? Like, you're short-staffed, what are you going to do, not make the sale? Of course not, I understand. But you can't regularly create an environment where that happens. Yeah, with no intention of changing it.
Because customers can tell. They might not be able to pinpoint exactly why a game master is not being attentive, but it's going to affect their experience, and they're going to write a bad review, they're going to complain about it, they're going to write about it on Facebook, they're going to tell all their friends, hey, I paid $30 for this game, and it was fun, but the person who was watching our game was either mean or rude or wasn't paying attention, even if they weren't trying to be mean or rude, but ignoring your customer could come across that way.
Right. I also think it depends on your market and what you're competing with and where you're located and what the expectation is. Like, for, I'm speaking from an Orlando perspective where we live in a crazy high tourist area where the customer service is Disney World.
Yeah.
Right? So, like,
a customer could ask for the most ridiculous thing and they're going to say yes.
Right, because they are spending time with the mouse where their customer service is exceptional, and if they had spent the morning at Magic Kingdom and they're going to come play our games, like, they're expecting the same level of quality. Do I think you need that level of quality if you're, like, in North Dakota? Maybe not.
We love North Dakota. If you're from North Dakota, we don't mean that you have a bad business.
No, I just mean, like,
it's just not the same market.
Yeah, so, like, it depends on where you're located. I think your customers deserve one game master per game.
Yeah. I agree.
Long and story short. Your employees deserve to run one game at a time.
It's difficult to run more than one game at once, guys.
Yeah, it's very hard.
Especially for people who have short attention spans or get distracted easily. Because even watching just one game at a time can sometimes be hard, or like you need to run to the bathroom and you miss, you know, a minute or two of your game and you're panicking because you don't know what they were doing. Right. Like, I can't imagine being in that situation watching two or three games at once. It would just be a nightmare.
Yeah.
I would get so stressed.
I've watched two games at once for, like, shorter amount of time. Like, hey, watch this for a second while this thing happens. You know what I mean? Or, like, I have to answer the phone. Can you watch them for, like, 5 minutes? You know what I mean? Like, and that's
not usually a problem.
Right. That's an understandable situation, which makes complete sense.
It's just when it starts affecting the way your customers experience the game, that's when it starts becoming a problem.
Right. And if it is, like, very hard for doing it for 5 minutes, if that is your standard, there's no question that your customer service
is lacking.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. So we talked about that for a while as well. I feel like we are having longer discussions than I anticipated for each of these topics.
I told you this. You didn't believe me.
I really didn't believe you. All right. So that brings us to our next topic, which is, should the game master be in the room with the customers? Okay, I think my answer to this is,
I think it depends.
Yes or no. Yeah, it depends.
Your game master should not be in the room, not in theme. In my opinion, you should not have just, like, Joe Schmo game master hanging out in the room watching you play the game, because
that's weird. It's weird. People think it's uncomfortable and they don't like it, and you think they're sitting there judging you, and they are. Customers like to have a veil of ignorance. They know that you're judging them, but they don't want to see you judging them.
Right. I also like the veil of ignorance. Yes. We go play games, and I know that you're watching me. I know exactly what your screen looks like, probably, and how it's happening. But when I'm in the room, I don't think about that, because you are not there.
Right. And it's just uncomfortable to have someone standing in the room watching you. However, it can really enhance the experience if there is someone in the room who is there as a resource to give you clues in a game master type way, but in theme and integrated with the story, and there's actually a reason that they're there versus they're just sitting there in their regular clothes timing you on their phone or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. In my experience, we've had in-game game masters in a bunch of different ways, and some of the best ones are, like, temporary in-game game masters. So, like, you get a dose of interaction, and they're in character, like, in-character interaction and clues and conversations and that kind of thing, and then they go away, and, like, you can play the game in peace. It's, like, just enough to enhance the experience. We've had some where we played that game that had a bartender in the room as a game master.
Ooh, yeah, that was fun.
That was fun. It also, it was, like, 60% of the game versus the whole game?
It wasn't the whole game. Yeah, I like that game. And he wasn't there for the entire time. And he was also serving drinks.
Yeah, so he had a purpose. And he was asking, like, if we asked him, we weren't, like, asking him for a clue, necessarily. But, like, we could be like, hey, like, could you help me out? Like, kind of in character. And he would say something also in character that was, like, a point in the right direction, but not, like, investigate the bookshelf. You know what I mean?
Right. It was more of a nudge.
Yes.
Than an outright, have you tried looking at this particular thing in the room? Which is something you might give as a hint as a game master, but not, it's not in theme, obviously.
Right, yeah. I think the best hints are immersive clue systems in general, but I understand that that is a very tall order. So I appreciate anything that is not grossly immersion breaking, such as Joe Schmo sitting in the corner on his phone.
One day you're going to meet someone named Joe Schmo.
Probably not.
And I'm going to feel bad about all this crap we've talked about Joe Schmo. No, but I agree. I mean, it does take a large investment to make an integrated clue system that might involve a lot of tech. It might involve paying a live actor or whatever. But there's a difference between doing something like that, which is, you know, on one way end of the spectrum, versus having someone just randomly sitting in the room. There are ways of having an in-room game master that can be low budget if you don't have the budget for, like, a huge surveillance system or whatever. So there are creative ways to do it as well that doesn't just involve spending all of the money putting in all this high-tech equipment.
Right.
Any other thoughts about that?
That one was brief.
That one was brief. I appreciated it. Next, we'll discuss our thoughts on giving unprompted clues.
I talked about this earlier, kind of, where I ask customers what their preference is. That is because I hate, usually, unprompted clues.
Strong wording.
It depends. It depends. There's a difference between unprompted clues and unprompted nudges, in my opinion.
Or hints.
An unprompted clue is like being railroaded to do something.
So explain what being railroaded means.
It means someone is telling you to do something so that you will get through the room quicker.
Someone is working on the railroad and you are the choo-choo.
No.
Okay? And they're laying the tracks to lead you in a certain direction without you finding your own way.
Yes. In other words, they're telling you exactly what to do without you asking for help. I understand. Trust me when I say that I understand that you are watching the game and you are frustrated that they are dumb. Okay? And they're not figuring it out. And you want to tell them so that they can move on to something else because you can think of everything else that you'd rather be doing than watching them figure out whatever the puzzle is that they're supposed to be figuring out. But they paid you
to solve the
puzzle. To solve the puzzle.
It's also so frustrating watching someone struggle to figure out something that you know might be one of the easiest puzzles in the game. Most people solve this in less than 30 seconds, and this team has been working on it for 10 minutes. And all you have to do is click send on that clue, and they'll move on, and they'll actually get more than halfway through the game. But you really have to either, what Jocelyn's advice was, that you ask them ahead of time if they want unprompted help, or you have to feel them out. Does it look like they're also getting just as frustrated as you are? Like, does it look like one of them is kicking the puzzle across the room and dad is sitting on the floor in frustration and not working on it anymore?
Yeah, I think it understanding the team that you're watching is the most important part.
Which is super difficult to figure out.
Yeah, you are shaping the experience that they're having, right? So if you can tell that they're having a horrible time, and like she was saying, like, dad is on the floor and frustrated or whatever, and you just tell them something small that lets them connect the dots and they feel like they saw something and give them the accomplishment, that is improving their game. You see they're frustrated and you just tell them the code is 1234.
They're going to be like, okay.
Right, like, that's not improving their experience at all. It's actually making it worse.
Right, because it's making them feel like you think they're so stupid, they couldn't figure it out, so you just told them the answer.
Right, and I also think it's totally fine if someone says, hey, we don't want to do this puzzle, can you just tell us what the answer is? Sure, then you tell them what the answer is, right?
Yeah.
You have to gauge the situation, and if you are unclear, in my opinion, it is always better to ask them, in the moment, what their preference is.
Do you guys want some help?
Right. Like, do you want me to point you in the right direction? You know? And, like, if they're super frustrated, they're going to be like, yes. Please. Usually.
Or, if they don't care that they've been solving an easy puzzle for 10 minutes, they'll be like, no, we want to figure it out. And you're like, okay. And you ease off, and you just take their lead.
Right. I ran a game for these people who knew that they were not very good, and they were crazy enthusiasts, and they were like, we don't want any help, we just want to try to solve it, and if we can't do it, we'll come back and we'll play it again. So, like, everyone has their own preference of how it should happen, and the biggest thing to remember is that it is their experience, not yours, and you are controlling how they experience it.
Right, and you have the power to either push their direction in a, I'm even more frustrated now because you're just telling me the answers, or, yeah, I might not have been able to figure it out, but all I needed was just a little bit of help, and then I could figure it out on my own. So that people tend to have a lot more positive experiences with that than with just outright telling them what to do, even if they have been working on it for a long time.
Right. This has kind of turned into a
Game master advice episode.
Episode, which was not our intention.
Yeah, so, I mean, from a player perspective, everyone's going to have a different opinion, right? Sure. There's going to be, like we said, the people who want no help, the people who say, if I haven't unlocked something in 10 minutes, tell me the answer. And there's everything in between. So from that kind of perspective, you're going to get a different answer from everyone.
Right. And I think it goes to show that, like, when we first started playing games, we did not ask for clues. Barely at all.
Right. You have to learn
what is important to you changes. Right? For me, what's important now is, yes, solving the puzzles, but also I want to see the whole game. Right? So if we're stuck on something and we've been stuck on it for 10 minutes and we're going nowhere and we're getting frustrated, sure, give me a clue. Right? But I know where that line is, and I will ask you for it.
Right. After playing 200-something games, you learn. But I think bottom line about this discussion is, if you haven't opened something in 10 minutes, something is wrong.
Ask for a clue.
Ask for help. And your game master, if they're good, should be able to recognize if everyone in the room is yelling at each other and having a terrible time, and they should be able to help you.
Yeah.
And if they're not, then you can ask, obviously. Yeah, I mean, I don't have anything else to say about that topic.
I have more to say, but we should move on.
We should. Our last topic for today's discussion is about, quote, established industry rules. Do you want to elaborate on what I mean by that?
Quote, breaking established industry rules.
Right. What does that mean?
So I've been seeing this conversation go around based on a puzzle somewhere that is about putting a fork into an electrical socket.
We have never played that game before, nor do we know any specifics about that particular puzzle. Right. We've just seen it multiple times come up in conversation.
Yeah. We know that the conversation exists and I have had a lot of discussions about it in general. One side of the argument is that the idea that putting something in a room that breaks the established industry norms of what you're allowed to do is detrimental to the industry itself and creates bad player habits.
I feel like the myth about player habits needs to be dispelled. Because
I cast dispel magic.
Yeah. No. Stop with your Dungeons & Dragons nonsense here, okay? This is a podcast for adults.
Yes, adults play Dungeons & Dragons. Okay. I bet.
Anyway, my point is that most enthusiasts go into a room, and if the game master asks them, have you played escape games before? And you kind of chuckle and you're like, yeah, a couple. And you tell them how many you've played. They're like, okay, well, you know all the rules, right? Don't go into the ceiling. There's nothing hidden behind wallpaper.
You don't break anything.
You don't need to break things. You don't need to climb on furniture or whatever. So that's what we mean by, quote, established industry rules. Kind of things that no matter what escape room you go to should be kind of the norms of the rules that there are.
Right.
Don't stick your fingers in electrical sockets. Yes. That kind of thing.
However, I am of the opinion that the industry is so new that there aren't really established rules, at least completely, and the draw to the industry is experiencing different things and approaching problems in different ways. So I love moments in games that are similar to the fork and the electrical outlet thing.
Although maybe not quite so dangerous?
Sure, yeah, but things that are like, am I really allowed to do this? Like, is this what I'm supposed to do? Is this going to break anything? Like, is this okay? Whatever. Like, those are the best moments in games to me. And if you start wanting to take those away because you personally as an owner or someone like that are scared that someone is going to play that game and come into your room and stick a random fork that they have in an electrical socket, that is more detrimental to the industry, that idea, than the act itself.
Yeah, and on a side note, I don't think that your escape room should have live exposed electrical outlets anyway.
Yep.
It should not be designed that way. The customer should not have access to them in the first place, but that's a different discussion.
Yeah.
So, I agree mostly. I kind of disagree that there are no established industry rules because, I mean, there are certain things that you go from place to place and you know that you're not supposed to do or you know you're not supposed to try or whatever. But that's not to say that just because you don't have to jump on something in one game or climb on the furniture, that doesn't mean that if there is a ladder in one game that says go up, you shouldn't, because all of the other games say you're not supposed to climb on things.
Yeah, I also think it depends on the rules that are established at that particular venue. Right? So if you are an owner or a game master and you have something in your game that is different than the industry norms, you need to at least make your players aware of it a little bit without spoiling it. So instead of saying like, you know, don't climb on the furniture, you can say like, don't climb on something unless you have explicit instructions to do so.
Right. I was going to say that you have to make it very clear that that is the correct solution.
Yes.
So like, for example, there have been games where you have to use a specific tool to break something or unscrew something or otherwise manipulate.
Yeah, like deconstruct.
Deconstruct something that you wouldn't normally in another game, but you're specifically given that tool or object to perform that task. So you know exactly what you're supposed to do. And even though it feels uncomfortable, like, am I supposed to be unscrewing this? Because it feels a little wrong. But you know that you're supposed to do because that's what you were given. Versus right. Someone who goes into the game and they have a Swiss Army knife and they're like, look at this electrical outlet. It has little screws around it. Let me try unscrewing it with something that I brought in from outside the game. Obviously, that's not what we're talking about here.
Yeah. If you are given specific tools to solve the puzzle in front of you, you're going to feel like you are allowed to use those tools. That does not mean tomorrow when you go to a different game and there's something that also has screws that you assume that you can use your hand to unscrew it. I think that the idea that letting people deconstruct something in one game will mean that they think they are allowed to just rip everything apart in other games is not giving the customer enough credit.
No, I don't think people are going to assume that just because they did it in one game. That's the whole fun of escape games, is that they're all different.
Right, yeah. Also, if you have one game master watching your game and someone starts to take something apart, you can tell them to stop.
Integration between all of our controversy topics. You know, I actually thought of some more topics that we didn't discuss here. But maybe if you guys enjoyed this episode, we can continue to talk about escape game controversies in other segments for you.
Yeah, maybe we can find someone who has a different opinion than us so that we can deeply discuss something as well.
And if you have a controversy that you would like us to discuss, please let us know. But for today, that's all I got for you.
Don't sound so sad about it.
I am sad about it because this was actually really fun to
rant to the camera without someone telling me that I'm wrong.
Just a couple of housekeeping things at the end. There will be no episode next week.
Aw.
I know.
Tell them why.
Because we're going on an insane escape game road trip from Orlando to Houston to play at Strange Bird Immersive. And then from Houston to Baton Rouge to play at 13th Gate Escape.
So it's going to be a wild ride, friends. And therefore, we don't have any time to record or edit an episode next week. However, because we're going on this trip, we're going to bring you amazing content after that. Because not only are we playing at Strange Bird Immersive, we are also doing an interview with the owners and creators of that experience. So we're super excited and looking forward to that.
Yeah, so not next week, but the week after that will be an episode that is a Strange Bird review and a conversation with the owners, similar to our Exit Games episode last week.
Yes, and then we're going to be doing a review episode of our 13th Gate experience as well, which is going to be super fun because we're bringing along some escape room owners and another game master friend with us. So it's going to be a good group.
Yeah, so we'll see if our well-rounded team
actually escapes.
Yeah.
We're going to be playing 5 games in a row. We're starting with Death Row, then Asylum. Guys, I'm playing Asylum. if it's horribly scary, please let me know and maybe I'll chicken out. No, I won't. Okay, so we're playing those two, and then we're playing Tomb of Anubis.
We're playing Spellbound first.
Spellbound and Cutthroat Cavern. Yes. Is that it?
Yep. 5 in a row. Is that it?
I just mean they... I didn't know if I said them all. Anyway.
Yeah.
And then after that, we're driving 10 hours home.
So stay tuned to our social media accounts, where we will be posting a bunch of Instagram stories of us in the car. We're going to record some episodes in the car, so when we come back, we will have tons of content for you.
And also wish us luck.
Yeah.
Because I have to go to school on Monday morning after all of this. Also, stay tuned for a special announcement next week that we're going to be having for you as well, so get excited about that. And I think that's it for today.
If you want to follow us on social media to see all of that awesome road trip content, check out our Instagram at Escape Expeditions.
And on Twitter at ESC Expeditions. On Facebook, we are Escape Expeditions. And our email is escapeexpeditionscontact@gmail.com.
We also have a brand new website.
Woo! Get excited!
Escapeexpeditionspodcast.com, where you can find all of our content in one place.
You can find links to all of our social media, our Facebook, which is social media, YouTube, also social media, and all of the iterations of where you can find our audio content, as well as a comprehensive list of every game that we have ever played, if you're interested in taking a look at that. And Jocelyn has been working very hard on uploading individual game reviews to our YouTube channel. So if you are interested in watching only a particular review for one game, head on over to the YouTube channel and you can watch it there. Also, stay tuned next week for a special announcement
about how you can get even more Escape Expeditions content.
Because you just can't get enough of listening to us talk.
On that note, have a great week.
Bye-bye.
Your destination is on your left. The end of this podcast.